KetoCon is the world's first and only conference dedicated to the science and the stories of the ketogenic diet and lifestyle. This year, KetoCon will be held in Austin, Texas from June 15th through the 17th. We'll have speakers from around the world sharing their research and life experiences about the benefits of keto. And we want you to come be a part of it too. Last year was amazing, and this year is going to be even better. You'll have the chance to meet and mingle with keto folks from all walks of life. You'll find great new keto products, and you're going to make lots of new keto friends who understand how the keto lifestyle can empower you to take control of your health and show the world just how awesome you really are, because you're awesome. So how can you be a part of this incredible experience? That's easy. Just go to ketocon.org/shop and get your tickets for the keto event of the year. That's ketocon.org/shop to buy your tickets now. Oh, and when you get there, come find me. I'd love to say hi. You're listening to the Keto Evangelist Podcast, where we're powered by ketones and carbs are for suckers. My name is Brian Williamson. I'm the owner of KetoEvangelist.com, and that is a site dedicated to all things ketogenic. And each week on this podcast, that's exactly what we talk about. It's all things ketogenic. And this week, no exception, we're going to be talking to a low-carb, high-fat, ketogenic dietitian from Canada. So sit tight. If you'd like to learn more about the ketogenic diet and lifestyle, I would encourage you to go to ketoevangelist.com and sign up for the newsletter. In exchange for your email address, you'll receive one shiny brand new ebook full of all the foods that you can eat and still stay ketogenic. It is a win-win. That's five wins. All right, cats and kittens, sit tight. We got a great show coming at ya. One of the best things about doing this show is I get to meet a lot of really cool people, virtually anyway. And almost to a person, they're just really easygoing, really laid back, especially when I screw up things. So like just now, like I had to do the intro to this twice. So my guest today has had to sit through that. She had to suffer through that, the first take that got screwed up and do it a second time. So, She's very gracious, and I appreciate that. But hello, everybody. This is the Keto Evangelist Podcast. I'm your regularly handsome host. My name happens to be Brian Williamson, and I just wanted to welcome my guest to the show today. Coming to us from Canada, Joy Kitty. Hi, Joy. How are you?
Not too bad. Yourself?
I am well. So now, here's the thing. I have a habit of butchering people's names, but your name seems pretty simple to pronounce. So I'm waiting for the other shoe to drop. Like it's pronounced an alternatives like way. So did I get it right? Is it Joy Kitty or is it?
It's Joy Kitty. Okay. Joy is in joy to the world, not Joyce with a C-E on the end, which a lot of people want to add, but
sure. Yep. Okay. So now from Canada, you are a dietitian. Now I want to clear this up right off the bat because, this is something that you are, passionate about. What is the difference between a dietitian and a nutritionist? Now, I realize that it may depend on the country that you're from. So I want to say specifically from your perspective, as being Canadian, what's the difference?
In Canada, a registered dietitian is a licensed title. So just like someone can call themselves a doctor if they're a member of a college, someone can call themselves a registered dietitian or use the initials RD after their name if they are a member of a college of dietitians in Canada. A nutritionist can do diet, nutrition education, write books, do written materials, but a registered dietitian can design diets, whether it's for well people, sick people, as well as do many of the things that nutritionists can do. The other thing is someone who's a nutritionist doesn't need to have a degree at all. In Canada and in the United States, in the UK, people can call themselves nutritionists without having any degrees. You can hang a shingle on your wall and say, I'm a nutritionist. Whereas a registered dietitian is a specific reserved title for someone with at least a bachelor's degree from a recognized university plus an internship.
Right. So it's not just the degree. You actually have to go through sort of a post-grad program of some kind.
Right? An internship. It's called a stage where I went to school. I studied at McGill in Quebec. I'm from Montreal. And so it's called a stage there, which is just the French word for internship. Here it's called a clinical internship. And then I went back to school later in life and did a master's degree in human nutrition.
So, okay, being that you're from Montreal, I assume that you can speak French as well.
Mais oui, je parle français aussi.
Okay. Now I have a question. Now I've had a couple of other French Canadian speaking guests on the show, and I've asked them all. So I want to ask you in the same vein.
Am I a hockey fan?
Well, okay, that was my second question. But since you broached the subject, tell me you are. You've got to be, right?
I am definitely a Montreal Canadiens hockey fan. Okay. I grew up in the Montreal Forum. One of my best friends growing up, her father was the general manager, and I grew up in the Forum overlooking the ice.
Really?
I did.
Wow, I feel like I'm close to celebrity at this point. That's kind of cool for me.
Not really, but I love the Habs and I love hockey.
Okay, so I think that you're required to, regardless.
Because you're from Montreal, right. I think it's pretty well
right.
You either like poutine or you like the Habs.
Oh, right. And you can't like poutine. So you've got to like...
Well, I always thought it was disgusting even before I was low carb.
So my original question was about the difference between Canadian French and French and French French. So
that's totally easy. I can explain that.
Okay.
Because my grandmother, who raised me to a large degree, was from Paris.
Okay.
And she spoke, of course, international French, Parisian French, and insisted that I didn't speak Quebecois, which is a joie la patois. It would be like saying the English we speak compared to Cockney English.
Okay.
So Quebecois is essentially a modern version of 17th century French, and it degraded from there. If I spoke to you in Quebecois... C'est pas français comme ça, là. That's
okay.
The way they speak. And it's, mais oui, je parle français. Very, very different.
I see. So, now here's my suspicion. And, this is part of my appreciation for conspiracies anywhere I can find them. I suspect that part of that is just Parisian French's desire to continue looking down their nose upon as many things as possible. This is my suspicion. Because they've got England right there and they're now looking, you know, they're not satisfied with just that. So even amongst French speakers, you're not the mother tongue, even though they can understand. And I've been told before, and you may correct me if I'm wrong on this one, but I've been told before that Parisian speakers may understand Quebecois completely, but they're going to act like they don't just because.
Absolutely. You know what? It's interesting from a historical point of view, because in Quebec, as an Anglophone, which is what an English speaker is called, even though I'm fluently bilingual, I'm still an Anglophone. Uh-huh. Even when I speak French, it's not pure laine, as the Quebecois would say, pure wool. Uh-huh. I speak a international French. I don't speak Quebecois, so they won't speak to me either.
Okay, gotcha. All right, so it goes both ways. It's
yes, it does. Right. It continues.
So I'm a big fan of language. So I find I call this the politics of language, right? And it fascinates me because ultimately we're just talking about how to. I mean, really, when you get down to the nitty gritty, language is how you convey the human experience to another being, right? I mean, that's really what it is. So any chance that you can to simplify that and clarify that, I'm all on board, but it seems like people want to complicate things unnecessarily. But that's a topic for a different session.
Different show.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about you more. So you said that you went to McGill, which is in Quebec.
I did my undergraduate at McGill in dietetics and human nutrition. I did my internship at the Jewish General Hospital in Montreal. And then I conceived my twins, who came, let's just say, 3.5 months early, which put a little bit of damper in my practice for a while, and stayed home, played mommy, had 3 kids in 13 months, stayed home, raised my kids, and then went back to school, needed to upgrade my skills. Mm-hmm. Naturally, it was a little bit of time I was out of from McGill, and decided to do that together and went to University of British Columbia, did a master's degree and upgraded my skills and became a licensed dietitian here in British Columbia.
Okay. So did you, like, you chose your degree program from McGill, being nutrition sciences in that vein. Was that something you were always interested in, or was it just something that you just sort of fell into?
Well, it's very interesting. My first choice career-wise was to become a teacher. I'm an artist by passion, and I wanted to be an art teacher. But back in those days, we won't say how many years ago that was, there wasn't a lot of demand for teachers and English-speaking teachers in Quebec based on the politics of language, which you probably know a bit about.
Right.
Wasn't a lot of demand for English-speaking art teachers. And so I was trying to think of other things that interested me to do. I did about a year and a half in computer science at Concordia University, Montreal.
Okay.
Survived barely and realized this is not for me. And then I thought about what would I really love to do? And I always had an interest in nutrition, human nutrition, from the time I was 16 years old and worked in a health food store and decided that's what I wanted to do. But wanting to get into McGill when I had no science background required me to do almost 3 years of prerequisites to switch from fine arts and education.
Really?
To become a dietitian. Yep. And so my passion started then, and I got into McGill and graduated with distinction, and the rest is history.
Okay. So you had to take a bit of a break because the kiddos, they rely upon someone.
Yep.
And so you went back to UBC, University of British Columbia, yes? You chose, now, did they have different, so it's a master's degree, but you could have taken various routes, I'm assuming. So why did you pick human nutrition? And I'm assuming within that human nutrition degree, you could have chosen certain concentrations, or is this?
I did. Okay. I was very interested at the time in studying mental health nutrition, specifically ADHD, because as it turned out, three sons had ADHD, one of each of the subtypes. So I was I had an experimental study going on at home.
Right.
And I decided I wanted to know more about than what was known about nutrition, human nutrition, and ADHD, and did research, published my research. There's a link on my webpage if you want to read it. I conducted research interdisciplinary with a psychiatrist and the human nutrition department at UBC, and published.
So I'm curious because, and correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm going through a master's program right now in applied nutrition. And one of the things that I'm noticing is the sort of revelatory aspect of when you point out to someone that there is possibly a connection between the food you eat and your mental well-being, you know, regardless of, because people often don't make that connection, right? For various reasons. So when was it that you decided, or when was it that you realized, okay, there's probably something like nutrition related that is tied to the ADHD, ADD thing? Like, how did you make that connection? And I realized that you were raising three children. So clearly there was like an N equals one or N equals three experiment going on.
N equals three.
Right.
Yeah.
So was it just because you were a mom and you'd seen it firsthand, or did something else kind of trigger that to say, you know what, there's probably something here we should look into?
Well, I knew about Feingold's research in the 80s, maybe it was the 70s, with red food dyes and sugar and hyperactivity.
Right.
And nothing had been done since then. No one would touch it. It was like anathema. Don't go near this. I also knew about the research being done with DHA and EPA, the fish oils, and depression. And I knew that they were tied to dopamine and serotonin receptors and fish oil. And I had a hypothesis that ADHD was related between nutrition and neurotransmitters. And that's actually what I was interested in. I wanted to know which foods resulted in which neurotransmitters, which nutrients were prerequisites to which neurotransmitters, and whether a deficiency in those nutrients was more likely to be found with children with ADHD. And I, in fact, found conclusive. My study worked, and I found that kids with ADHD were lower in iron, zinc, and copper. And I was the first one to discover that they were low in copper. So it was pretty cool.
Okay. So I'm curious, if you don't mind, I'd like to kind of explore that a little bit. You were looking at the intersection between nutrition and neurotransmitters, right? So sort of, was it micronutrient? Was it macronutrient? How do these
micronutrients?
Right. So what I'm saying is, like, from your perspective, you're thinking, okay, you have to rule out certain things, right? So you have to rule out, okay, it's not macronutrient composition that has something to do with it, right? So you rule that out. That leaves micronutrients. So you're talking vitamins and minerals, right? Then that's not controversial, right? So how do you determine, how do you get to the point where you've been able to narrow it down to say, oh, it's iron, copper, and zinc? Those are three things that we see.
I spent 2 years doing a lit review, and I came across one zinc study, which had been done at the time. And I went to my mentor, who's now assistant head of the Department of Food Science at UBC, and said, which nutrients are precursors to dopamine and norepinephrine, are the neurotransmitters involved in ADHD? He says, I have no idea. Why don't you go do some research?
Okay.
And so I took two courses, this independent study, and went and found which nutrients they were. It was vitamin C, iron, zinc, and copper. And so I said, well, if ADHD involves dopamine and norepinephrine, then let's look at the nutrients that are precursors to them and see if they're low in kids with ADHD. So I designed a study, applied to get it funded, won a scholarship to fund it, which also paid some survival money for myself.
Sure.
And conducted the research.
So when you were looking at whether or not something is low or high, you're looking at it based upon some sort of measure, right? Now, is this, were you basing it upon a governmental recommendation, or were you working on some other sort of metric that you were determining, okay, this is low based upon this measurement?
That's very interesting. I was looking, actually, the name of my study is the dietary in nutrient. I don't remember now. Nutrient status and nutritional intake of children with ADHD. So I was looking at both what they ate as compared to other children of their age and their blood work. So it was very objective data compared to standards. So their lab work was lab results. And then I compared their results, their lab results, to a normal population. And then I looked at other data, other ADHD data that was available, kids of the same age, socioeconomic background, et cetera. And so it's objective lab standards, kind of very boring science, nerdy stuff.
Well, I mean, that's science, right? So you basically, so just to make sure that I'm understanding you correctly, so that the people who are listening are following along, just to be on the safe side, there is a population of subjects who are diagnosed with ADHD or ADD, and there's a population of subjects who are not diagnosed with it, and they're not diagnosed because they don't actually have it, right? Not that they're misdiagnosed. So we're saying that.
I wasn't comparing subjects that didn't have ADHD. I was only looking at subjects that had ADHD that were diagnosed with ADHD and comparing their blood work and their nutrient intake to a normal population.
Right.
Which
was and that's what I'm saying. There's a population of subjects that were not diagnosed with ADHD. That's what you're calling them, the normal population, right? The control sort of population, right?
Yeah. Normal in quotation marks.
Right. So I just want to make sure that we're understanding that that's what you're saying. Yeah. So it wasn't that you were looking at it and saying, oh, the government says it should be this. So, and it's below that. Therefore it's low. You were looking at this is the inference principle that pervades science, and it has to, right? That you look at the preponderance of data and you say, okay, all of the subjects who are diagnosed with this particular affliction demonstrate or present with these deficiencies in these micronutrients. All of the normal data that I look at, none of that occurs. So therefore, we're saying that because it's lower than what would be considered the normal population, sort of the control population, that is how you determine that it was below a certain level. It wasn't an arbitrary number that someone threw out, right, is what we're saying.
I think the only word I would take out of the equation is the all, because it didn't require every single individual in my sample to be below that. But statistically what percentage was below, and, you know, doing all that very boring statistical analysis to determine what percentage were and whether that was statistically significant, and which it was.
Okay, so it was statistically significant.
It was for iron, zinc, and copper.
Okay. Now, you also mentioned vitamin C as one of the precursors necessary. So I'm assuming that you did not find any statistical significance to vitamin C levels. And when it came to that,
I actually didn't test vitamin C. Okay. I looked at iron, zinc, and copper because they are mineral micronutrients, and I decided to stick with just that.
Okay, so is it possible that vitamin C does have a role in that, or is that irrelevant at this point?
It wasn't relevant to my study because of where in the pathway it came in. It didn't really affect the outcome that much. It is one of the precursors, but if you look at the pathway, the micro minerals were of much more significance. So I isolated my study to that.
Gotcha. Okay. So now this is after taking a hiatus to raise kids, right? You didn't just, It wasn't like you were just, sitting around not doing anything. You know, you raise your kids, you go back to school, and all of a sudden you're throwing in this thing where you discover something that science hasn't discovered before, right? So
it was very cool.
Right. So that's got to be an ego boost for you, right? I mean, you got to feel good about that, I'm sure.
I wouldn't even necessarily say it's an ego boost. It was very satisfying to be able to come up with a hypothesis, test the hypothesis, find it to be valid, publish the research, and now there's about 37 other papers since I published my research that quote my study as a reference. So it's very gratifying that there are other researchers basing their science on the soundness of my science. So it's gratifying as a researcher.
So did you then immediately when you realized with definitive results that you got, did you immediately start making your kids eat more zinc?
Actually, I ran my kids in the sample at the time on the side to see how they compared to the data and analyzed them separate and apart from to see where they fell in the spectrum.
Right.
And then contemplated doing a PhD study at the time, talked myself out of it that I would never do a PhD study.
Right.
Which has since changed since I've discovered low carb and keto, halfway considering going back and doing a PhD. But trying to talk myself out of it because I said I'd never do that again.
it's certainly a thing, right? Like that's, it's not a simple endeavor or an easy undertaking to try to pursue something like that.
Well, it's having questions and wanting answers.
Right.
And, you know, I guess it's just part of the left brain, right brain thing.
It's also about having some sort of academic support system, be it peers or mentors who are willing to help, assist, support, that kind of thing. Because if the world of talking about politics again, right? The world of academia is political, right? So
very, very.
If you go to someone and say, I'm looking at doing research in this area, and they don't want to touch it with a 10-meter pole, you're going to have a harder time finding, you know, the ability to do that. So, as sad as it is, it's just that's the life we live in. That's the world we live in. Okay. So you mentioned, that's a good segue. So you mentioned, that you found low carb keto stuff. So how do you go from, getting back in, working through your master's program, becoming a published researcher, a well referenced published researcher? Like, what led you to keto at that point? How did you get to that?
There's a little bit of time in between. I worked in industry for a little while, and then I opened my private practice about 10 or 12 years ago now here in BC. And I work full-time in industry and then part-time in my private practice, and then decided to go into private practice full-time. And it's been about 7 years now, I think.
Okay.
And I see clients, in my office, and I also did phone consultations. And pretty well normal nutrition stuff, doing food allergy, food sensitivity, irritable bowel syndrome, you know, losing weight, gaining weight, pretty run-of-the-mill stuff. And having had 3 kids in 13 months, I managed to gain quite a bit of weight and not lose more than maybe half of it at one point, and then stopped and treaded water for probably 15 years. And myself, stories have been hosted on, I don't want to mention anyone else's websites, but a well-known international.
It's perfectly okay. You were talking about...
Okay, Diet Doctor picked it up and on the year anniversary of me becoming low carb, because I had lost so much weight and inches and was a dietitian that did it, they picked up my story, and it's kind of been taken on a life of its own. But how this all happened was a year ago, 3.5 years ago, actually, this May, and today is May 1st. So it's pretty well 3.5 years ago, four years ago, a girlfriend of mine who's a retired physician came to me and came to my office actually and said, my husband's got these various health issues and I'm seriously thinking of having him follow a low carb diet. What do you think? Let me just take a sip of water, if you don't mind.
No, go right ahead.
And so I was like, okay, well, you know, what kind of low carb diet are you thinking of? And then she was mentioning Jason Fung in Toronto, who's a nephrologist, who's rather well known now, but wasn't very well known 4 years ago, and mentioned his webpage and was telling me about his approach and his reasons for his approach. And we were discussing the physiology. And I said to her, I remember learning all those pathways. You must too. And she said, yeah. And I said, well, what happened? Did we just chuck them out the window and start teaching Canada's food guide? Or like, what happened? And she goes, I don't know. I've been kind of wondering the same thing, because we all know, you know, like we all learned those metabolic pathways.
Right.
And then promptly taught that, you know, fat causes high cholesterol and, you know, we need to have more carbohydrates because it's somehow good or other things. And so I started to read through Jason Fung's blogs at that point. And at that point, he only had a year and a half worth of blogs. And it took pretty well 3 months to read through all of them and look up all the, and he had them all linked to studies. So I would read through the studies and say, well, that, it says what he says it says.
Right.
And then it was like, now I got a big problem. I either keep teaching what I've been teaching, or I fundamentally changed my practice.
Right.
I couldn't unsee what I saw and unread what I read and unlearn what I had learned. And so I realized I had to change my practice. And so at that point, the clients that I was seeing who came to me for weight loss and to lower blood sugar and lower hypertension and lower their cholesterol, I basically asked them to give me some time off to come up with a new template to formulate a meal plan based on the information that I had read at that point, and then design a meal plan based on this information. And they all except for one client wanted to do this. So the other client, I designed a conventional meal plan and I said, if you change your mind later, come see me, which they did.
Right.
And they ended up doing a lower carb approach later. And the rest is history. That's 4 years ago this week. And time passed. I started low carb myself. Things happened. Just in a life happens and gets in the way of our goals sometimes. And I didn't follow through with it. A year ago, March 5th, this past year, I didn't feel well. I was I seen a client in the morning and was sitting at my desk like I am now and felt really unwell. And I was like, I don't know. I don't feel well. So I went and took my blood pressure and I looked at it and went, that can't be. So I laid down on the bed, took it again after like 10 or 15 minutes and it was 199 over 100.
Okay.
And I went, this is really not good.
Right.
And then I decided to take my blood sugar because it had been a while, like 2 years. Mm-hmm. I was in, like, talk about classic denial. This was classic denial. An obese dietitian with type 2 diabetes for 10 years, hadn't taken her blood sugar, hadn't taken her blood pressure, and had been 2.5 years since I went for blood work.
Okay.
So I collected the data. I had hypertension. My blood sugar was through the roof. It was 13.0 after eating lunch.
Okay.
And I was like, this is not good. This is really not good.
Okay, so this may be a an unfair question for you though. If you were to translate 13 to sort of how the U.S. measurements go, is that
I can do that. I got a little calculator that does that. So 13.
Because it's going to be over 200, right?
I think it's like 202 or something
okay.
like that.
Okay.
234 okay. milligrams per deciliter.
Yeah. So that's super high.
Yeah. That's right up there with having 199 over 100 blood pressure. Right. And I sat there and I thought, if I go to my doctor, he's going to send me in an ambulance to the hospital.
Right.
He's not going to send me home with meds because my blood pressure was nuts.
Right.
And I thought, I'm going to die. I had two girlfriends within 3 months drop dead, one of a heart attack and one of a stroke, my age. And both were in healthcare. One was a nurse for 35 years and the other one was a long-term care worker.
Okay.
And now I'm going to say this with the biggest disclaimer possible. I do not encourage anyone to ever do what I did.
We get that a lot. So go ahead. Yeah.
My advice, what I should have done was go to the hospital, get the meds, and right. then change my lifestyle. Because right. what I did was really stupid, but I didn't. I was in denial and I was scared. And I said, no, I'm going to change my lifestyle now. Mm-hmm. And I wrote myself a diet plan like I do for my clients, a low carb diet plan. I started myself at 50 grams of carbohydrate and I started following it that day. And that was the beginning of a long process because it turns out I'm the most insulin resistant of all any client I've ever seen.
Really?
And had to, yeah, absolutely had to keep dropping down the carbs, turned around my blood sugar. I mean, I'm now in the non-diabetic range blood sugar wise. I'm at 6.4 hemoglobin A1C. My fasting blood sugar is around between 5.2 and 5.6,
okay.
You probably want in. Let me see what 5.2 is. See, I'm so lame. I have to have this calculator on my.
That's going to be below. That's below 100.
94.
Okay.
94. Yeah. That's 5.2. That's at the low end. And let's say on a really high day, like this morning, it was 105.
Okay.
So it's pretty good. And my lipids totally turned around. My triglyceride to HDL ratio is like 0.34 or something.
That's
totally.
Yeah.
Like really, really good. And my blood pressure came down. It was touch and go. You can read about it on my webpage, a low carb, high fat dietitian, which is LCHF/dietitian with a T. And all my, I have my, all my blogs are divided into like science made simple articles and recipes and my N equals one story. So all my data is there. Blood sugars, blood, cholesterol, blood pressure. And a year later, when diet doctor picked it up, I had lost 30 pounds. It's now like 35 pounds. 8 inches off my waist, 3 inches off my neck, and 1.5 inches off each arm. And I feel amazing.
Sure. Okay. Now, I want to go back to something that you said a little bit a while ago, because I want to make sure people understand the conundrum that you were in. When you were talking about you were confronted with research. You were confronted with empirical data that stated facts that are, or data that was clearly contradictory to what you were told and what you were teaching, right? Yeah. Now, you were saying this is a fundamental problem. And so I want to make sure
that cognitive dissonance.
Right. Well, aside from the cognitive dissonance, right? The fundamental problem is, like, when we first started the interview, I wanted to make sure that we laid out what the difference between a dietitian and a nutritionist is. As a consequence of being a dietitian, you are beholden to certain governmental regulatory agencies. And if you begin your practice contradictory to them, you run the risk, or you potentially run the risk of losing that licensure, right?
That's right.
So it's not a simple matter of, oh, I just need to go by the science, because you may lose your ability to call yourself a dietitian at that point. Yes.
That's actually quite right, which is why the science made simple articles on my webpage are fully referenced for the last 8 months or so.
Right.
Because I fully expect that I'm being watched. I'm not talking about paranoid. I think you were talking about the conspiracy theories.
Yes.
It's, you know, we certainly can name some very well-known doctors who have faced incredible, censorship from their colleges and from dietitians, unfortunately, in some other countries. And it's not unlikely that, I'm being scrutinized for what I say and what I do. So I'm very careful to say, this is what the guidelines say. This is what the literature says. And I'm looking at peer-reviewed studies, published peer-reviewed studies, quoting the references. And so in my Science Made Simple articles on my webpage, you can read about Finian Volek's work. You can read about the research done, you know, the 2-year studies, the 3 2-year studies that have been done. You can see the 78 references to low carb, high fat, studies that have been done and what's been found with relationship to saturated fat, what's been found with relationship to, hemoglobin A1C or fasting blood sugar reversal or, remission of type 2 diabetes, hypertension, etc. So it's because I'm a scientist, because I'm a published researcher, and because I desire to continue to remain a dietitian, I document the science behind what I do and why I do it. So, because as professionals, my college requires me to be evidence-based.
Right.
Evidence-based means it has to be based on evidence. What became clearer to me as I started looking into the history of the dietary guidelines, both in the States and in Canada, was that when they changed the dietary guidelines in 1977, there was a belief, I believe, that there must have been really good, solid scientific evidence on which to make those changes, and have since found out that there wasn't really solid evidence for making those changes. There was some really well-funded research by the sugar industry with our good friends Hegsted and who was the other guys? I can't remember their names. And who went on to work on being the editor for the 1977 dietary guidelines in the States, since found out that the Canadian guidelines, which claim to be independent of the American ones, but really aren't, adopted the exact same guidelines here in Canada. And then I started looking at, well, what did people, I'm old. I'm old enough to remember what people looked like in the 60s and 70s. They were skinny.
So I
started looking at pictures of people in the States and Canada, what they looked like in 1960, and I went to 67.
Right.
I went to 1970. Sorority pictures, fraternity pictures, people on the subway. They were skinny. It didn't matter. White, black, old, young. And I'm going, that's how I remember. Everybody looked like Leave It to Beaver.
Right.
What happened? Then I started to connect it with 1977 guidelines and then the politics that was involved with that, and going, there really wasn't the solid evidence that I was led to believe or assumed to believe. I don't know if anyone ever told me there's solid evidence. I think we all assumed, as whether my girlfriend as a physician or myself as a dietitian, that there was solid evidence, and there wasn't.
Right. I mean, so this kind of stems from, in the US, it stems from the McGovern report. He was a senator out of North Dakota, I believe, who was essentially following a vegetarian diet, and he was looking for anything that proof texted and supported his view. And he dismissed anyone that was interviewed who disagreed with the approach of vegetarianism, and produced this. This is in the 70s, and it's well documented. And in the US, the 1980 was the first year we had federal guidelines coming out of the USDA. And it was essentially following exactly what the McGovern report stated, you know, a lot of wheat, a lot of carbs, keeping saturated fat down. And it's all based upon fallacious, it's not based upon causative evidence. It's based upon correlative evidence. Mm-hmm. And nobody drew the distinction. Well, I mean, that's not true. There were plenty of people drawing a distinction, but they were shouted down, right? There were plenty of people who said, we can't do this. This is not right. And they were told to shut up and sit down, basically. Mm-hmm. And luckily our neighbors to the north, Canada, totally followed suit.
We usually do. I mean, you lead the way and we go, yes, sir. Yes, sir. That looks good with us, because we don't have the money to fund all that research from scratch. So we just assume your research is good and, you know, get a couple of our top researchers, to look it over.
Right.
Of course, and give their stamp of approval.
Right. And that's the thing that amazes me, is the folks who look it over, they don't seem to do it with a critical eye. Like they're already sort of halfway convinced that it's right. And they're just kind of, and I don't want to say they're shirking their responsibilities necessarily, because I'm not there. I don't see exactly what they're doing, but I look at the evidence that's been presented, and I'm not the smartest guy. And I can look at that and find flaws in the research. So someone who's well educated in that subject, I would imagine would be just as equipped or more so to find those same flaws. And yet they didn't. And yet they didn't seem to want to draw attention to those things for various reasons.
I think if the, and I know, I happen to know one of the researchers actually who was involved in that decision. It was on my committee as a master's student, and she's mm-hmm. very brilliant and very knowledgeable. And if you don't know that the studies were funded by the initial studies with Hegstead were funded by the sugar industry,
right.
and you don't know that 10 years before Ansel Keys came out with his seven-country study, there were 22 countries worth of data that right. existed.
Right.
So I call it a 7 out of 22 country study.
Right.
If you don't know that, you look at the 7 country study, that's really convincing data. Look right. at it's published. Guy's got a Nobel Prize or whatever he's got. You look at Hegstead stuff. These are 3 guys from Harvard.
Right.
Look at the research. But if you, you know, when we found out that that was funded by the sugar industry, that was November 2016.
Oh, yeah.
When there was that retraction in the New England Journal of Medicine. And all of a sudden, so, you know, hindsight's 2020.
Right.
Those researchers looking back, knowing what they know now, what they could know now if they read it or considered it, they have to, and this is why, you know, the Canadian clinicians for a low carb, high fat diets is promoting that the Canadian government relook at the evidence because they didn't have that knowledge when they made the decisions in 77 and 84 and, you know,
right.
2005 or whatever, 2010. And to relook at the data because we all assumed it was sound, peer-reviewed data. And when you now involve the sponsorship of the sugar industry to produce research that says that fat, saturated fat causes heart disease, and then the same guy goes on to edit the 1977 dietary guidelines, and then you have, you know, Ansel Keys coming out with a 7 out of 22 country study, 10 years after data was known on those, Joe, just throw out that data. It doesn't, we're not going to study those countries.
Right.
Because it didn't fit the, of what he, I mean,
and that's,
as a researcher,
well, that's the
people like to get their name in there. So right. I guess if you don't include the data, it's,
well, that's
you're not budging anything. You're just not including it.
That's the insidiousness of science, right? And this is a pet peeve of mine. And right? Like I'm very much of a scientific bent. However, people seem to forget that human beings are the ones doing the science and they're just as flawed just because they're a scientist
That's right.
as anyone else. So there's this idea of finding the evidence that supports your hypothesis. That's not science, but that's what happens, right? That's what yep. happened. And that's exactly what Ansel Keys did. And of course, Dr. Yudkin, John Yudkin, was one of the loudest yeah, critics saying,
exactly.
you know, there's no way this is true. I've got evidence. I've got empirical, objective, mm-hmm. not supported by the sugar industry evidence right. to show that sugar is the reason. All like his point was all of the things that you're saying that saturated fat is causing, I can prove to you that sugar yeah. is the actual cause. And the response from Ansel Keys and the I call it the Ansel Keys mafia was, was not to say, let's see the evidence. It was to ad hominem attack
mm-hmm.
and insult him in the literature. Right? And they just yeah. had bigger typewriters, basically. You know, they had more people, and it was within a decade, they had the American Heart Association and all the yeah. Canadian equivalents as well on their mm-hmm. side because they were the ones who were screaming the loudest, saying the most ridiculous things. Mm-hmm. And that's where it is. So, I mean, that is the human aspect of science, right?
I only discovered all of this politics stuff when I discovered I heard about the November 2016 paper in about a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
And started writing blogs about this, in the last 6 months and got into the politics of it. And it's made me angry,
mm-hmm.
frustrated. And then starting to see the whole effect of seed oils. And I wrote a blog about this. I found a paper. Mm-hmm. This is a little bit of a rabbit trail, but it ties in. I was doing an article on Canada's food guide. And I have in my office all of the Canada's food guides from 1977, which I happen to be the original owners of from back then. So I'm old enough to have them. And in the back of my 1984 Canada's food guide was an old yellow piece of paper. And I pulled it out. It's on my blog. I scanned it in so you could see how yellow it is. And it was provided to us at McGill for determining what healthy fats are. Mm-hmm. It was sponsored by one of the producers right. of vegetable seed oils.
Right.
And I started to realize when I started doing the research that they, this company who invented a lard imitation, they used to be in the soap business and they decided that that being in the food business was good. So they took stuff that was designed to be used for soap and bleached it and purified it and sold it to us as Crisco.
Right.
It was the same company that was going to McGill and giving papers to future dietitians on what is healthy fats.
Right.
And I looked at that paper. That paper to me epitomizes what I didn't know about my education when I became a dietitian.
Right.
Was the involvement of the food industry or the soap industry that became the food industry.
Right.
On what I taught as a dietitian as being healthy.
You know what amazes me about that, like I said, because I'm kind of going through this right now, is nothing's changed. You know, it's there. So I'm going through a program right now, and I thought for sure, this is how naive I am. I thought for sure, because I'm like inundated in the ketogenic world every day. So maybe I'm just too much of an echo chamber. But I thought for sure that there would be more understanding or acceptance of this low carb, high fat approach, call it Atkins, call it paleo, call it keto, banting, whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. But it is so not. It is still completely ingrained in these very outdated, non-supported, just erroneous approaches. And so I just want to share with you two things. I was reprimanded by one of my instructors, for advocating a ketogenic approach, in a case study that we were doing. Mm-hmm. And the reason I decided to sort of show my hand was because the case study was supposed to present a very difficult scenario, obesity, diabetes,
it's hard to avoid. Yeah. Right. How do you not?
Yeah. So I look at this and I'm like, this is easy. You know, mm-hmm. I've got the answer to this. You know, let me rephrase that. I've got a potential solution for this that why not give it a shot? Cause mm-hmm. what you're doing now is not working. Anyway. and I was reprimanded for it. And I was told that even though I supplied research, I cited articles, peer reviewed articles to support my points. I was told that it wasn't enough. It wasn't new enough, or that it wasn't, the preponderance of the evidence wasn't there. In other words, because over the last 40 years, everyone's looking at a particular thing and only a handful of people are looking at the other thing doesn't matter, right? Even though it provides variables that destroy the mainstream, right? Or that really cause pause when it comes to the orthodoxy.
Yes, pause.
So, I was told that. And so my response to my instructor was, can you supply me evidence? Because this is what I was being told I needed to supply. Can you supply me evidence to show, for example, that saturated fat has a direct causative, deleterious causative impact on cholesterol, and that cholesterol response is in fact bad, mm-hmm. proven bad, not correlatively bad, proven, like without beyond the shadow of a doubt. She pointed me to the American Heart Association website, which has no supporting data. It just makes statements. It has no support whatsoever on there. Like it just says saturated fat is bad. There's no like footnotes or here's some studies. So I said to her, I appreciate you sending me to the American Heart Association, but there's no supporting documentation. There's no evidence here. And she said, well, that's an authority. That's our authority. So they don't need evidence. I'm like, you're kidding me. You're kidding me. So again, it's this ingrained thing. And it kind of drives me nuts. Now, the other thing I wanted to ask, or I wanted to bring up to you and kind of ask, you have those Canadian food guides from 1977 up till the most current one. And I have looked through, the USDA guidelines from 1980, cause they do it every 5 years, from 1980 mm-hmm. up until, 3 years ago. there is only one substantive change in the past 35 years in the US. And that was, well, maybe we don't need to worry about cholesterol so much. That was really it. That was it.
That's the only major change in yours, correct?
Right. So in the Canadian one, is it the same? Have you noticed any kind of differences or changes? Or is it essentially the same, just repackaged 1977 version?
Well, we never had the cholesterol thing in there. That's okay. The only difference between the American and the Canadian one. There is a substantial change, and that's been in the obesity rates. So if you look at 40 years ago with the same food guide, both in Canada and the United States, minus the cholesterol recommendation in the States, we now have 1 in 3 Americans obese and 1 in 4 Canadians obese. And 40 years ago, which I am old enough to remember, it was 1 in 10 was obese.
Right.
So it's been an epidemiological experiment gone terribly wrong.
Right.
And I believe that it's the when I first started my low carb journey, and then which became ketogenic, just out of necessity for myself, I wasn't able to achieve the kind of levels that I wanted just being low carb. I had to myself become ketogenic. When I first started this journey, it was carbs were the issue. Too many carbs, the 45 to 65% carbohydrates. And over the last 6 months, particularly first initiated by Dr. Eade's talk at Low Carb Breckenridge, and then doing some reading from Tucker Goodrich talking about industrial seed oils.
Yes.
And then finding that handout, that old yellow handout in my food guide, realizing that this has been a perfect storm between increasing the amount of carbs and the simultaneous, well, if saturated fat is bad, then we need to have the substitute frankenfats for people to use. And I think it's a perfect storm of those two things together, resulting in the obesity. And it's just been a perfect storm. Decrease saturated fat. Well, you have to have more polyunsaturated fats. We don't have any. Well, we'll invent some. So they invented soybean oil and they invented canola oil. These were all invented when I had that 1977 food guide. So this is in my lifespan. I'm old enough to remember skinny people in public.
Right.
That's how old I am.
Right. As Nina Teicholz talks about that in her book. And one of the things that was fascinating to me is to learn a lot of these vegetable oils, these seed oils, they're industrial consequences of other manufacturing processes, and these industrial applications were really happy to find out, we can sell this as oil, as food. Okay. Cause otherwise they had to throw it away. Right. And now
it was garbage, in the soap making, manufacturer. I blog about this as well. I actually talk about, you compare, like people call it polyunsaturated vegetable oil. Well, if you look at an olive and you squeeze an olive between your fingers, you get oil on your fingers.
Right.
If you take an almond and you squeeze it between your fingers, you get oil on your fingers. You can squeeze a soybean as long and hard as you want, and you're not going to get any oil out of it.
Right.
As a matter of fact, when they invented soybean oil, they squeezed it under hydraulic presses for 3 years and got no oil out of it.
Right.
So it was only when they started using hexane and other solvents and then bleaching it, high temperature solvents bleaching, that they were able to produce this wonderful.
Right.
And then we went and did canola oil. Oh, it's Canadian. It must be better, right? Well,
right.
It's got a different ratio of N3 to N6, which of course is supposed to make it healthy, like higher N3 to N6
right.
or lower N6. It's still, you can squeeze a canola seed
right.
and you're, anyway.
Right. It's still inflammatory. It's still, it may be better than soy oil, but it's still bad for you.
Exactly. So I think it's the combination of both. And I'm trying to tease out the mechanism now. I'm picking Gabor Erdossi's brain, trying to understand the mechanism, reading through studies, trying to understand what is this interplay between the inflammatory process of the N6 seed oils and the too many carbs that has created this perfect storm of obesity. Because Dr. Eade's presentation at Low Carb Breckenridge really—it
opened a lot of eyes.
It was like, okay, this guy's totally hit on something. And so I'm reading through studies he was kind enough to send me, and studies that Gabor has sent me, and I'm trying to understand the physiology and then write about it in my Science Made Simple article. So people who don't have a science degree can actually understand what the problem is. So I'm written through a series of articles on my webpage that have to do with the problems with these seed oils, how they're produced, the problems with carbs, and are all carbs the same? I mean, I'm going to be burnt at the stake as a heretic. I think there is a role for certain carbs after people go through metabolic reversal of symptoms to try using glucose monitoring and insulin monitoring to see if they can tolerate very low amounts of certain carbohydrates, which they may or may not be able to tolerate. Sure. So it's not a question of saying nobody should ever have a carbohydrate based food again. But to do it in an evidence-based fashion, could somebody such as myself, and I conducted experiments on myself 2 weekends ago to find out if I could tolerate, for example, whole chickpeas, a half a cup of whole chickpeas. And actually I could, whereas a year ago I did it and my blood sugar went up to like 9 point something and it barely went up at all. So I'm like, okay, well, maybe with reverse, you know, healing of beta cells and reversal of insulin resistance in periphery tissue, small amounts of carbohydrate could be eaten sometimes.
Well, and I think the key there is the sometimes part of it, right?
Like, yeah.
Because what often happens in that scenario is people tend to swing the pendulum the other direction in terms of license, right? Like, oh, okay, I can eat this. Now I can eat anything. And that's when they get themselves in the bed. So you have
We have continuous glucose monitors.
Right.
People don't have, I mean, I got to get myself one because this pricking my finger every 30 minutes for 3 hours is a stupid way to do it.
Right.
But I just wrote an article that I just posted like 15 minutes before I came on to be interviewed that we have no excuse for making guidelines for diabetics that are based on glycemic index and glycemic load, which is for healthy people. Right. That is measured in healthy people. We have continuous glucose monitors that cost $50 and a sensor for 2 weeks costs $90. You could get really extravagant for under $300. A diabetic can test every food they want to find out what their glycemic response is and know exactly whether they can tolerate small amounts or not.
Right. And to know, and what I find fascinating about that is, obviously the insulin resistance levels are variable, not just among individuals, but even within an individual, right? Like right now, I might have a certain insulin response to a particular carbohydrate food, which just, by the way, just so you know, I'm pretty much just a carnivore. I don't really eat any carbs at all. But having said that, if I were and I had an insulin response or a blood glucose response of some kind, there's no guarantee that tomorrow having the same amount at the same time of day would elicit the same response. So those things are important.
Absolutely.
And knowing that
gut biome apparently has a lot to do with that. That Israeli study, I think it's 2015, showed that people's gut biome, the bacteria in their lower intestines really determines how well they can tolerate which carbohydrate.
Right. And, you know, that gut biome constitution is always changing. You know, we're talking about colonies of bacteria that are dying off, that are being born, you know, just different things. So, I think that the human variability is a fascinating thing for me. And I think it's really overlooked by a lot of people. You know, I'm going to say something controversial. They use science as a crutch because if they can just point to the science, they don't actually have to do anything for themselves, right? As opposed to like, see how you actually respond to it. You know,
that's exactly what the article I just posted is about. We have the opportunity, or I have the opportunity as a dietitian, rather than following guidelines that are like glycemic index and glycemic load and even insulin index, which says how much insulin is released.
Right.
We now have the opportunity of basing each individual's diet on their individual response to carbohydrate.
Right.
As you say, at different times with different amounts, even different amounts of grinding. Like you could do whole chickpeas versus, you know, hummus ground up, and it's going to be totally different because of the way, you know, the incretin receptors view it, if it's intact or it's not intact.
Right.
And we now can customize diets for people. And this is what dietitians such as myself can do. Someone who's type 2 diabetic or insulin resistant doesn't have to base their whether they're going to respond to a food based on glycemic index or glycemic load, which is for healthy people, people that don't even have type 2 diabetes, they can base it on their own response. We have the technology. Right. Why are not we not doing therapeutic diets for people with type 2 diabetes? We do it for people with celiac disease.
Right.
We do it for people with food allergies. It's about time people with type 2 diabetes get the same rights.
I totally agree. And I think that's one of the most common themes that I've spoken to people such as yourself in the healthcare, professional healthcare community, that the oncoming trend of individualized help and support and treatment, as opposed to, you know, and let's be honest, it's in the past 50 years, we were limited by technology. We have the technology now. Exactly. So we don't have to cover everything with a really broad brush. We can individualize that. So that was kind of, I'm glad that you brought that up, because that was leading to my next question. And I know that we're running a little bit long on time. So,
that's fine. Okay. I'm fine.
I wanted to ask, like, what, now that you've kind of, you've adopted keto as your own personal diet, you've done the research, you're continuing to do the research, you're considering doing more of your own research. How has that impacted your ability to treat patients? Because the stuff that you put on your site, you obviously say, you know, it's supported by the evidence, but are you still allowed to treat your patients along those lines as well? Or are you still required, based upon the governing bodies, to avoid that sort of thing? Or, like, how do you walk that fine line?
Well, that's very interesting, because I was looking at the 2018 recommendations from Diabetes Canada came out 2 Mondays ago. And so I pored over it and wrote a blog about it, naturally, about what they now allow, which is a little bit different, which they allowed in 2015. They only come out every 5 years. But 5 years ago, they allowed for individualization diets for people with type 2 diabetes based on their preference. So if an individual with type 2 diabetes wants to have a low carb diet or a ketogenic diet, and that is their individual preference, then based on that, even in over the last 5 years, I would be allowed to provide them with that, even though the recommendations are they should have, you know, 193 to 252 grams of carbohydrate per day, which is what Diabetes Canada diets provided. If they wanted to eat differently, if someone doesn't eat pork because they're kosher or halal, or they're vegetarian and they don't eat meat, or they're only carnivore and only eat meat, as a dietitian, I need to provide them with the best evidence-based care based on their personal decisions.
Okay.
So it seems to be written into even 2013 that you can individualize treatment within the specifications of an individual. The new 2018 guidelines have come out and give opportunity now for there's a low carb, in quotation marks, diet within the context of a Mediterranean style diet. So I wrote a blog about what is a Mediterranean style diet? That is that Ansel Keys version of a Mediterranean, or is it actually what they eat in Italy? Like, Asim Malhotra would talk about the POP diet, which Mediterranean are we talking
about? That's exactly right. Yeah.
And so there are recommendations. And again, I kind of break it down in my articles, my Science Made Simple articles. Well, this is what it says. What does it mean? So it seems that as individuals have provide consultation both in person and long distance consultations via Skype. And if a person says, I want to do a low carb diet, can you help me teach me how to eat healthy on a low carb diet? My task as a dietitian is to make sure that they get all the nutrients that they need from the diet that they want to eat, because that's a personal preference.
Right.
If they didn't eat, if they were lactose intolerant and couldn't digest milk, or they were celiac and couldn't have any gluten containing grains, am I going to say, you're not going to have all the food groups? You're not going to be eating these food groups.
Right.
You can't do this. Well, it's not any different for somebody who is has type 2 diabetes or insulin resistance, or has hypertension that's secondary to those things, or dyslipidemia, cholesterol problems secondary to those things. If they want to follow a particular style of eating and they want a dietitian to provide them with the healthiest diet possible within those contexts, there's really, when you look at the nutrient analysis of a low carb or a ketogenic diet, it can be designed. I like to use the term Dr. Stephen Finney uses, a well-designed ketogenic
diet. Well-formulated
ketogenic diet. Because if it's well-formulated, they're getting superior nutrients than the average American or Canadian eating a standard American diet. And certainly, there are no nutrients that are not available from every other food that they're, you know, low carb fruits. There's, you know, higher fat dairy products. I mean, there's literally no nutrients that they're missing, short of maybe vitamin D intake, which you have to supplement anyway, living in the 49th parallel up here in Vancouver.
That's right.
Doesn't matter. We have to take vitamin D if we eat a Canadian diet or we eat, you know, a ketogenic diet. So I don't see the difference.
So then my curiosity then becomes, do you ever have to nudge any of your clients? Like, you have to sort of respect their wishes. So do you ever have to say, are you sure you don't want to try a low carb keto diet? Are you positive you don't want to try that?
Maybe 4 years ago I did, because I was new at it. I have people now, I had a couple in my office yesterday who were going, we've read about you. You're famous. You're all over the internet. We Googled your name and you came up like, you're on Diet Doctor and you're on this one and you're on that one. I'm like, okay. And they said, we want to do this. I want you to do it for my husband. He's got, you know, this, that, and the other thing. I want you to do it for me. So I don't have to nudge people very much. Sometimes people come to me and they don't, cause I have my main practice and I have my low carb, LCHF dietitian practice. And the reason I split them off, they're both one and the same, is because I didn't want to overwhelm people who came to me because they have food allergies or food sensitivities or IBS.
Sure. Or
getting all of this low carb stuff. And I had someone write me about a year ago saying, do you still do food allergies? And I'm like, okay, well, let's just make this. So I created the low carb, high fat dietitian website and moved all the stuff over there. And so I still have people coming to me for other things. But if, let's say they come to me because they have high cholesterol, well, you look at their blood work, and I look at blood work. Mm-hmm. People are afraid of needles, probably not the good person to come see, because blood work tells me a lot. I can tell a lot about how someone's eating, looking at their blood work before I ask them. If they're coming to me for high cholesterol and I look at their blood work and it's like, well, this is easy. This is an easy fix.
Right.
Then usually what I'll do is I'll introduce them to I'll say, you know, I have some blogs on another website that's affiliated with my practice, and I give them the card and I say, are you willing to read through some of them and let me know what you think? Would you be willing to try this as an approach? And so then they have the opportunity to educate themselves based on what I've written. It's all referenced. There's links. They can read the studies. I've not had anybody in the last 2 years not want to do this and really want to do it.
That's good. So from my perspective, that definitely shows some sort of sea change, right? Like there's clearly something going on. I mean, yes, you have a bit of celebrity, but aside from that, but let's be honest, you know, people aren't necessarily going to change their lifestyle just because they're in your office. You know, they're still stubborn people, but if the majority of people, or if a good preponderance of people, are coming in and willing to give it a shot, if for no other reason, what they're doing now is clearly not working, then that's a good thing, right? Trying that alternative.
There's two things that I think predominantly motivate people that come to see me either virtually or in my office to change. First and foremost, and I'm told this over and over again, it's the fact that I explain the science simply that non-science individuals can understand it, but not so stupid that people who have the science background can't follow the arguments. And it's fully referenced. So it's not just I'm giving my opinion. It's referenced. They can read about it. They can follow the trail and see if, in fact, what I say is true.
Right.
The other thing that and I don't think anyone comes to me because I'm a celebrity or because I'm on Diet Doctor. Or I'm on, you know, I've been hosted in different places or because I come up first on the Google search engine. I think people read my story about how I was an obese dietitian with high cholesterol, hypertension, and diabetic for 10 years, was in denial.
Right.
And they go, wow, she's just like me.
Right. Yes, exactly.
And so I'm just a human being like everyone else. I have a master's degree and a bachelor's degree. I graduated with distinction. I was fat like they are. I had hypertension like they do. I had type 2 diabetes. So I had to lose weight 1 pound at a time like everybody else.
Right, right.
So I didn't get any special privilege.
Right.
I didn't get a discount. I had to do it.
Right.
And when people ask me, was it hard? I said, no, that was the crazy thing. If I would have known about this, you know, 15 years ago, I wouldn't have had to been obese for the last 15.
Right. That's for sure. That's for sure. Okay. Joy, thank you so much. I know that we're running long on time. You've mentioned your websites a couple of times, and what they're going to be links in the show notes to lchf-rd.com. Yeah. And if you don't mind, can we also put a link in for the bbdnutrition.com as well?
Sure, absolutely. Okay. I do both consultations and for both practices virtually for people who live anywhere. So if people are looking for ketogenic and low carb, the lchf-rd.com is a place. And if food allergy, food sensitivity, irritable bowel. And irritable bowel actually plays a big role.
Yeah.
People have a lot of gastro stuff, mm-hmm. and it's related to this microbiome thing. It's tied in. So sure, that would be lovely.
Joy, thank you so much for coming on the show. A lot of really great information. I really appreciate you taking the time. Aside from your websites, is there any way that someone can get a hold of you? Are you on social media at all?
I'm on social media as the low carb, high fat dietitian. So it's LCHFRD at the ampersand sign before, both on Twitter and on Facebook. I have the low carb, high fat dietitian on Facebook. If you just Google that or put it in the search bar on Twitter, or people can follow me. That's where I post my blogs, and you can send notes through the contact me form on each webpage.
So we'll put links to all that in the show notes too, as well. Oh, so awesome. I really appreciate it. Can you stick around for a few minutes after we do the outro?
Sure, love to.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate it. You just listened to the Keto Evangelist podcast. If you'd like to learn more about the ketogenic diet and lifestyle, I would encourage you to go to ketoevangelist.com and sign up for the newsletter. In exchange for your email address, you'll receive one shiny brand new ebook full of all the foods that you can eat and still stay ketogenic. So listen, that was a great show. Lots of great information. Go back and listen to it again. Because you should. Also, hopefully it empowers you a little bit. Take control of your health. You do you. If you want to connect with me on social media, you can. I'm Keto Evangelist. I'm on the Twitters and the Instagrams and the Facebooks. You should follow me, because I'm fun. All right. Until next time, cats and kittens, keep being awesome. Powered by ketones.